You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey, y'all. What you are about to listen to is one of the guest seminars from the 4th ASGA Fisheries Science Symposium that was hosted in May of 2025 at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. ASGA Science Symposiums aim to foster a collaborative learning environment for industry leaders and guides and brand representatives and retailers, small business owners, media representatives, scientists, and even state representatives. And we were very proud with the crowd that came out and that we had a great representation of all those different categories of stakeholders for our fisheries. This year, we brought some new flair to the presentation topics. We focused on economics. There was a great talk about highly migratory species, and we even took a deep dive into great white sharks. And all three of our guest speakers were the top of their field, world-class, extremely interesting, and fielded a lot of great questions and Q&A sessions at the end. So without further ado, the audio to follow this intro is one of those guest speakers, and we owe a great deal of thanks to Sims Fishing Products. The Sims team has always been supportive of these symposium efforts and making sure that these events happen, that we're able to amplify good science and foster productive conversations. So a great deal of thanks to the Sims Fishing team, to the MBL staff, and to all of those who attended our symposium. We present to you one of our guest speakers.
On the way. So without further ado, thank you all.
All right. Thank you very much. Good. How are you? All right. I don't think I'll need the mic. I'm a professor, so I can project fairly well. If I do sort of trail off, let me know, but I don't think it will. So hi, everybody. Just wanted to say thank you for the invitation to come down here and speak with everybody. I think one of the most rewarding parts of my job, and I'll go into that just real quick, is the opportunities that we get to share the information from the research that we do with the communities who benefit from it. And I think that's sort of telling in terms of how passionate we are about the stuff that we do. And we want everybody to kind of know what it is. It doesn't do any good if it's stuck in a journal somewhere in a library at an institution, right? So my name again is Walt Golep. I'm an associate professor in the School of Marine Sciences at the University of Maine, and I wear a lot of hats besides this one. Three of them, actually. In my position, I teach classes at the university, generally undergraduate and graduate level, focused primarily on fisheries biology, fisheries science, fisheries policy, fisheries assessment. And I also am challenged or charged by the university with running what we call an extramurally funded research lab. And our lab, the Pelagic Fisheries Lab, focuses almost entirely on highly migratory species. So if you look at the definition of what a highly migratory animal is, according to the UN and other organizations, these are basically animals that travel without bounds except for the extremes and physiological constraints. So really, really cold, perhaps, really, really deep, or maybe really, really warm. But by all accounts, these animals can travel throughout the world's oceans, and they have what we call cosmopolitan distributions. They go everywhere. And the third hat I wear, and Greg wears it too, is also a sort of a policy and a management hat, in the sense that we represent and help domestically NOAA implement regulations and guidelines for highly migratories. And we also work at the next level, where I chair the US ICAT Advisory Committee. So that's the international level, where really all of the sausage is made. So when you fish for bluefin, and you fish for big eye and yellowfin, and you fish for marlins or swords, those decisions are not made here locally. Those decisions, and I'll get to this in just a minute, those decisions are made by 54 countries collectively throughout the globe, not just the Atlantic Basin. So it's a really complicated structure. So anyway, enough of my background. Again, we do work on a variety of the tunas, so big eye, yellowfin, skipjack, albacore. We do work on the marlins, we do work on swordfish, and we do work with pelagic sharks, thresher sharks, shortfin makros, poor beagles, and so forth. But for today's talk, what I think I'm going to do is I'll just focus on bluefin. It's the one that's most near and dear, I think. And as my friend John Graves says, no matter what the discussion point is, bluefin sucks the air out of every room because everybody is passionate about bluefin, and rightly so. They are truly a unique fish. They are actually in a group of fish similar to what Greg has talked about in terms of laminid sharks and what we call the true tunas, in the sense that they have some pretty spectacular physiological and morphological adaptations that only a very small fraction or percentage of the fish have. First and foremost, when you look at them, their body screams efficiency, right? These are like the Ferraris of the water, and they're fusiformed. They're generally very large if they can dodge the gauntlet of death throughout their life. Bluefins are documented in excess of 11 feet, and this is Ken Frazier's IGFA world record at just under 1,500 pounds, caught in 1979 in Alds Cove, Nova Scotia. Getting to some of those really unique traits, and white sharks do fall in this category, as do poor beagles and salmon sharks and short fin makos. There's 31 to 32,000 species of fish in the world. They are the most successful radiation of vertebrates on the planet in its history. There is no other radiation of animals throughout Earth's history that has been more successful. They inhabit everything from caves to hot vents and everywhere in between. But what's really neat about the tunas and that small group of sharks is they are a very small group of animals that can control their body temperature to some extent. So in other words, they're not warm-bodied, homeothermic like us, but they can maintain internal temperatures that are higher than ambient. And this confers all sorts of advantages. And you mentioned Frank Carey, right? Okay, so Frank Carey also did tunas. And in fact, these are his descriptions from Scientific America back using the same exact tags that Greg talked about, where he put acoustic tags into these fish and he also put thermistors into the fish. And he discovered that in bluefin, this is in Celsius, so sorry, the scale is a little bit different. But the water temperature here for this fish is 19 degrees and the interior temperature of bluefin is somewhere around 31 or 32. So the ability to stay warm, super advantageous. We all know that. Go snowmobiling, go ice fishing naked, and you'll find out real quick that it doesn't work out real well for you, right? Another reason, why can they pull so hard for so long? Their gills are an order of magnitude larger in terms of their surface area than other fish of comparable size. It's like you having the lungs of an elephant. It's the same kind of thing. So why can they pull on 50, 60 pounds of drag for 4 hours? It's because they're able to keep moving and keep that oxygen flowing. They have a very unique circulation pattern in their cardiovascular system. This is what a tuna looks like. You could say this is a cod, a striper, a bluefish, any number of other fish, and you'll notice that the systems are very, very different. They're also ram feeders and ram ventilators. This is an animal that can live 40 plus years. It will never stop moving, ever stop moving. It's negatively buoyant, so it sinks, and it also has to maintain forward momentum in order to breathe. Because they're adapted to fast swimming, they've lost the what we call the opercular buccal pump. So if you look at a striped bass and it's about to eat a bunker, I call him bunker, sorry, I'm from Connecticut. I went to Maine, they didn't know what a bunker was, it's a pogey. But nonetheless, a striper, for example, can open up its mouth, create that negative pressure and suck that piece of material into its mouth. Tunas can't do that, they've lost it. They've lost that because they can swim faster, so their skulls are fused. So they always have to swim to maintain their elevation in the water and to maintain respiration. Of course, like all the fast moving fishes, they have what we call a high aspect ratio tail, which means they can be really tall, but they're really skinny. It's a little bit counterintuitive because you'd think you'd want a tail that's really wide. It's very inefficient. The more efficient tail is the one that is really, really tall and very, very skinny. So blue marlins, for an example, blue marlin on a grander is probably gonna be about 48 inches or so. That's maybe 40 inches, I don't know. I'm just shy of 6'1", so somewhere around there, but it'll only be about that wide. And believe it or not, that's a very efficient tail. So we are very close to New Bedford, Massachusetts, which along with Gloucester and some of our older ports are sort of our historical fishing villages or fishing towns. And for our country, the history of fishing is pretty recent. I mean, we look at 400 or 500 years of, or maybe even 500 years of fishing history in the US, and we're like, wow, that's a pretty big history. But if you really want to see fishery history in action, you go to the Eastern Atlantic, you go to the Mediterranean Sea. Bluefin are confirmed to be on cave paintings 10,000 BC. Aristotle wrote about him in his History on the Treatise of Animals. He observed them coming into and out of the Med and doing this sort of counterclockwise rotational movement. The Greeks, the Romans, the Phoenicians, already had commercial fisheries in the 7th century, which you can sort of see right here. So this is a depiction of how they would do it. They would stand in these watchtowers. They would see the fish come up alongside the shore. They would row out in these, they're not dinghies, but some sort of a smaller boat with their seine net. They would encircle the school, and then it was a heave-ho and pull them all in. And then you'd bring them into the drying and the salting houses, and they'd be ready for commerce. Currently, bluefin are a very popular species. They support commercial and recreational tournaments from Canada to Texas in various types and capacities. And they also are growing in popularity in terms of their recreational component across the Atlantic Basin. And of course, they're very important for coastal economies because boat builders and fuel suppliers and tackle dealers and a lot of these businesses and individuals rely on that. And recently their populations have exploded. And we've really been the benefactor of some considerable conservation efforts. So right now their populations seem to be doing pretty well. So a little bit about fisheries and where they're caught in the Atlantic. Basically, since the early 80s, we have divided the North Atlantic Basin into two groups or two compartments, an east stock and a west stock. When I say east and west stock, that doesn't imply that these are different species. It's the same species. We've just sort of arbitrarily, and I'll show you this in just a minute, drawn a line down the middle of the ocean, and we say, well, this is one stock that we manage, and this is another stock. And here is sort of the history of bluefin fishing in the eastern Atlantic by gear type and by region. Almost all of the bluefin that are caught in the eastern Atlantic are caught in the Mediterranean Sea, actively spawning. In the western Atlantic, we are forbidden from catching bluefin on spawning grounds. So it's an interesting dichotomy that's been set up. And also a very big difference between eastern and western fisheries is the way that they are captured. In the eastern Atlantic, most of the bluefin currently are caught by purse seiners, followed by some catches with long line and then some other gears like bait boats and traps and things like that. The eastern Atlantic takes, their catches are quite large. Now they're on the order of around 40,000 metric tons. And if you compare that to the western Atlantic is a much smaller fishery. It's 10 times smaller, actually. It's 10 times smaller. We had some big catches back here in the 60s. This spike right here is actually the result of two things. It's the development of the U.S. commercial small bluefin tuna purse seine fishery, which is how we got our quota historically. And number two, it's the Japanese long light fleet catching bluefin off of Brazil, which only occurred for 3 years, and then it was gone. And it's never been there since. So it was kind of one of these really freak incidents of bluefin showing up somewhere that they haven't been. And then since 82, this has been the history of our fishery. Mostly other gears, others are harpoons and rod and reel, which are our largest categories, and then a little bit from purse seines and long lines. So just to set the stage, very different fisheries in the East Atlantic and very different fisheries in the West Atlantic. Now, the warm bodies, the fusiform shape, the tail, and all of these things, what did they do? They provide this animal the ability to travel extensively throughout the North Atlantic Basin and even down into the equatorial regions. Lots of countries pursue bluefin. It's a little ironic. Globally, bluefin account for less than 1% of total tuna catch, but they have 99.99999% of the attention of the global community. It's just the way that they are. And so they are a billion-dollar business collectively, in excess of a billion-dollar business. They're also highly migratory and they move around a lot. And of course, as we know, the ocean is dynamic. Things change. Temperatures go up, temperatures go down, currents come in, currents go out. And so when you have an animal that has such extensive capabilities of traveling throughout the ocean and crossing political boundaries at will, I mean, this fish can go from Boston to Wedgeport, Nova Scotia, in an afternoon. That's nothing. That's easily, they can go from Boston to Wedgeport in an afternoon if they wanted to. And so when you have something that can cross a political boundary so quickly and leave an area and come back to an area, it makes it really challenging to try to monitor it and to assess it. So what we're left with are a lot of these scientific unknowns, which makes assessment and management really difficult. And it's come to light recently that people are suggesting, you know, maybe we pull back from how we manage bluefin in terms of our participation in the international community. This is my opinion. You can take it or you can leave it. That is a very, very bad thing to do and a very dangerous thing to do, because the way that this fish travels, it cannot be managed alone. It cannot be. It's very different than, say, a bluefish or a striped bass. We have examples in our tagging database of fish that are crossing the Atlantic, you know, in a couple of months, right? And there's even records of fish crossing faster than that. So it really takes what we would consider an international or a group effort. And just real quick before I get into the science, this is how ICAT is set up. So ICAT stands for the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas. This is a regional fishery management organization, or what we call a RFMO, and it was set up back in 1969 as a way to manage our commercial tuna fisheries and somewhat of our pelagic sharks and billfishes, but it's primarily an organization for tunas. We have 54 countries that are involved. We are one of those countries. We signed a treaty. We agreed to abide by the terms and conditions of the treaty. And when it comes to bluefin, this is how much the three major countries get of the annual quota. Quota meaning the weight of fish that you can keep. The United States currently gets 49% of the entire Western allocation. Canada gets 20, and Japan gets around 21%. And that's how it's been for quite some time. So this is the allocation. So even though you have 54 countries in ICAT, there's really only three that get a piece of the bluefin pie in the Western Atlantic. And the Western Atlantic is everything west of the 45-degree west meridian. So the line goes like this. So everything over here is primarily just Canada, Japan, and the United States. And for those of you who fish recreationally, or maybe have friends who fish recreational or commercial for bluefin, I'm not going to go into detail here other than to say allocations for bluefin are really complicated. Really, really complicated. We have commercial gears. We have recreational gears. We have commercial gears who can fish recreationally or commercially, depending on which fish they kill the first part of the day. So it's really complicated. All I'm going to say about this is normally we would get 1,316 metric tons of fish, and they would be divided into these categories. Do not take that as do not take that as what's going to happen in 2025, because our quotas are going to be reduced because we had overages that we have to pay back. But if you're a recreational bluefin angler, this is how your angling category quotas are broken out here. So it's very complicated. All right, enough of the management and policy and boring stuff. Let's get into a little bit more blood, guts, stinky stuff that we do. So again, our lab focuses on highly migratories, and really where we try to fill the void is in that space of unknown biological information. So where are the fish going? How long are they staying there? What are the sources of mortality? How old do they get? How fast do they grow? When do they mature? Where do they spawn? All of these things are the prerequisites that you need in order to do what we call a stock assessment. So there's a lot of striped bass fishermen in here, right? Okay, how do we assess striped bass? There's a model, there's an assessment model that's run, right? And from that, you get an output. It's no different than bluefin or yellowfin or big eye. It's the same idea. You have a lot of biological ingredients, you mix them all together, and you get some kind of an output. Your output and the quality of the output is predicated on the inputs. That's where we are. We're in the input section of that. I don't have the math skills. John has the math skills, but I don't have the math skills to do it. So our lab focuses almost exclusively on that biological end of thing. One of the big parts of our program is we do a lot of biological sampling. In our program, since 2011, we've sampled around 17,000 bluefin between the Lubeck, Canada border, and North Carolina. So annually, we do around 20% of the bluefin fishery. And what I like to say is tissues tell the story. So I can take a piece of your fingernail or a piece of your skin or your muscle or your blood, and I can tell you what you eat. I can tell you how old approximately you are within a year or two. I can tell you what the contaminants are in your body and so forth. The same properties apply to the fish. The cool part is the things that we need to get that information are all the stuff that you all kick overboard and you don't want, like the guts or the heads and things like that. What the cool part is that that information that we need for the assessment is all stored in those tissues. We get this through a variety of different vectors. So commercial fishing vessels will help us. Recreational fishing vessels will help us. We work with tournaments. We work with commercial dealers who are really the pinch point for a lot of the commercial samples. And we collect things from muscle to liver, blood, otoliths, gonads, stomachs, and really anything that anybody needs. And again, we sample somewhere between 1,200 and 1,800 of the fish a year. And this is just us in various capacities at the dealers, at tournaments, and so forth. We have great cooperation. This is an example of that. This is a box of bluefin that came up from Wanchese. One of the commercial dealers put a box of bluefin on the truck for us free of charge, said, hey, they're at the office, come pick them up. So we have a lot of, I guess I'd call it buy-in from the industry in terms of they want to support this work because they feel as though it's worthwhile and their outcomes are going to be worth it. So what I'll do now is I'll kind of go into a few of the different things that we do. So one of the most fundamental aspects of understanding how a population is doing is understanding its age structure. So as you know, if you're catching fish, and all you're catching are 40-plus-inch stripers. If everybody is only catching 40-inch or bigger stripers for 1 or 2 or 3 years in a row, is that a good sign or a bad sign? Hypothetically, we'll simplify it. If all you're catching are big fish, and that's it for like 2 or 3 years, is that good or bad? It's bad because there's no recruitment, right? So age and growth allows us to get what we call numbers at age. How many individuals do we have in each one of those age groups, okay? George Permont, who is a commercial spotter pilot for the bluefin fishery for many years, has always said, I'm not interested in what's here today. I'm interested in what's going to be here 8 years from now. That was sort of his thing. He always was interested in the small fish. We also use age in looking at maturity. So we want to know how old those fish are before we sort of kill them. What we do is we go out and we collect all of these heads. And then within each of these heads, there are three sets of calcium carbonate otoliths. John's got them. He'll hand out a few of them to you. And what these little pieces, a lot of people call them ear stones. A lot of these otoliths are used for determining the age of the fish. And as I'll tell you a little bit later, where the fish actually comes from in the ocean. So we get some really good information. So we take the heads, we cut them. Once we cut them, we extract those otoliths, which you'll see there. We embed them in an epoxy and we section them. And what we see in those otoliths are these rings. So very similar to what we call dendrochronology. So if you went out here, right, if I went to my truck, got my chainsaw, cut the tree down, polished, sanded the stump down a little bit, put a little varnish or some water on it, you would see those rings, right? We all are familiar with the fact that those rings represent ages. We see the same rings in the otoliths. The problem is you need to be able to confirm that the rings actually represent a specific period of time. You can't just assume. And thankfully, we detonated thermonuclear weapons. So thank goodness we did that. Why? Because when you detonate thermonuclear weapons, you get what's called bomb radiocarbon that goes up into the atmosphere. It's an artifact of these detonations. And that precipitates into the world's oceans. So here we go. Start of the Cold War. Atmospheric carbon, up, 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 up. Let's detonate a 10 kiloton, 50 kiloton, 100 kiloton, and up and up and up and up it goes. That goes up. And then on the backside, it also comes down. This rate of increase and rate of decrease is captured in things like corals, and it's also captured in the otoliths of fish. And what you can do is you can match up those rings and the values on that curve. And that gives you your I don't know if validation is the correct thing to say, but that gives you your confidence that the rings that you're looking at represent the period of time that you are assuming it does in the otolith. And I do a lot of this work with Alan Andrews. This is one of his specialties, and he's done this for, gosh, I want to say probably 40 or 50 different species of fish. And it's been done for bluefin. We did it for tropical tunas, so big eye and yellowfin tuna. Yellowfin tuna in the Atlantic was not assumed to live beyond 11. Using this technique and the otoliths, we showed that they lived at least 18 years, if not longer. So it's a really powerful tool to add some confirmation to, are you actually reading a year and time of the fish? Now, these are really good looking otoliths. Normally they look like a Rorschach painting or ink blot where you just sort of throw ink, you know, or some sort of shape and you have to sort of figure it out. Every one of these red dots is presumed to be representative of a year. So what you do is you just, you sit on a computer with an image, you blow it up and you count all of those rings and you know the length of the fish and you, a lot of times you'll know, well, sometimes you'll know the weights of the fish. So you have the length, the weight and the age, and through that you can get your size at age information. We are also working on, and this has already been done, we're also working on what we call epigenetic aging. So DNA methylation of the coat as a proxy for being able to determine how old the fish is. The reason why we're very excited about this method as opposed to otoliths is that once you do this to a bluefin, they don't release real well.
Yeah.
So this is lethal sampling. The otoliths are fundamental for the fish sensing orientation and acceleration, things like that. You can't cut the top of the head of the bluefin off. If you found a way to then release it alive, let me know. That would be groundbreaking. But this is a lethal form of sampling. And so we only get a certain percentage of the fishery age data, whereas if we were able to use a non-lethal method by, for example, taking a fin clip or a muscle plug, we can let the fish go. And we can still get the age of the fish through this DNA methylation. And this is really big. We've got this going on for tunas. So us and colleagues, other colleagues throughout the world, it's been done for bluefin. It is ongoing for yellowfin and big eye. And we're doing some work. We're trying to do some work with this for swordfish and marlins as well. So it's really, really big, especially for fisheries where there is a high percentage of released fish. And again, the nice part about having this really long data record is you can start to construct what the age structure is of the bluefin that are captured in the Gulf of Maine. Now, mind you, these are mostly commercial fish. But on average, if you were to, I don't know if I would say randomly, but if you were to go out and you were to drop a line in the water in the Gulf of Maine, chances are most of the fish that you would caught would probably be somewhere between like 7 and 12 years old and somewhere probably between 75 and 95 inches. That's in general. Do we get bigger ones? Sure. We've had fish that have been 120 inches long. Do we get smaller ones? Absolutely. But in general, most of those fish are probably in that range. So it tells us, so all of the age work tells us about the distribution of the populations in terms of young ones, small ones, middle-aged, what our future recruitment might be. It helps us predict the future productivity of the stock. There is ongoing work with bluefin reproduction. That is probably the most drawn out part of bluefin life history that I'm aware of. Maturity for Western fish, it's still ongoing. The models suggest anywhere from 4 to maybe 12 or a little bit older. And as I said before, we have the epigenetic stuff going on. And what we always tell people who are participating in the program is, you know, please save the heads. The heads are really valuable for us. It doesn't matter if they come from a commercial fisherman or if they come from a recreational fisherman. I always say every fish tells a story. Every single fish tells you a story. You don't know what that story is going to be. Another thing that we do, hopefully this will play. You may have seen this before. I thought I'd show it because it's really cool footage. It is not mine. It was shot in the UK. The other thing that we do, we'll have to listen to an ad. Hang on a second. The other thing that we do, another one. Well, I'll talk while this is going on. Another thing that our lab does is that, and that we're very much invested in, if I can get the mouse to work, is understanding foraging ecology. Why? Well, I really break this down into two different categories. The first is more from a scientific perspective. We like to understand the trophic linkages and the energetic transfer of these trophic or of the trophic structure in the ocean. So who is eating who and why? And why would animals, for example, choose one prey over another? That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, especially for bluefin, is that many of the things that we and a lot of people before me and my lab have discovered about bluefin is that they tend, because of the fact that their skull is fused and their jaw, their gape is actually really small, they focus in on things that are small, pelagic, and very high in lipids or energy. Okay, so it's kind of like bluefins are chasing double cheeseburgers and not Caesar salad. Okay, well, Caesar salad with the dressing has a little bit more calories, huh? No, they don't always catch them. Well, it's similar to Greg's story with the seal, right? I mean, if they caught everyone, there wouldn't be any, right? So they, you know, the prey definitely have evasive maneuvers that they can do to get away from them. And so that's the second part. They're eating animals that themselves we also value. Atlantic herring, valuable as lobster bait. Historically valuable as a personally consumed fish, right? Small little herring. Atlantic mackerel, same thing. Consumed, used as bait, and now more recently in the Gulf of Maine, Atlantic menhaden. So again, I call them bunkers, pogies, whatever you want to call them. All of those are commercially fished. And so we want to understand what the top predators are eating and in what proportions, because there's movement afoot now to be able to incorporate that into those assessment models a little bit and allocate carve outs. So you allocate a carve out for bluefin or the whales or the birds or whatever it is. You missed that one too.
Those half beaks, they're...
I think they're a sori. I think so. By the way, these are UK bluefin, so US bluefin are way better at catching them. These are UK. Anyway. Okay. Sorry, I gotta advance this. Sorry. All right. This is my footage, actually. So that's a Tinker mackerel right there. And again, this is up in Canada. But again, what we do is we try to understand, you know, what the animals are eating, because it's really important. We know through history, and I'll get into this a little bit more, but we know through history that bluefin have been very consistent. I don't know if I would say specific, but they've been very consistent in terms of what they're eating. And again, they've mostly focused on small, there's another Tinker mackerel right there, small pelagic prey. Herring has been the mainstay for 30-ish years in the Gulf of Maine. But we all know that herring is pursued commercially as well. And so again, the idea is that you're striking a balance between what we want to be able to take out of the industry for the industry. Nobody wants the industry to go out of business. That's not the intention. But at the same time, you want to be able to fill that gap for industry and fill that gap for ecology and make sure that the top predators, because right, we have lots of different user groups. And one of those user groups are the folks that are going after the top predators. So we want to make sure that they're here. I often equate bluefin to gaming theory, right? You're at the table. You're throwing crap, you're throwing the dice. If it's great and you're hot, you're gonna keep going, or you're at the slot machine, you're pulling the thing, right? Win, stay, lose, leave. That's basically my theory for bluefin. And they have the ability and the mobility to get out of town really quick. So if there's nothing here and they don't see a need to stay, they're gone. And they're 100 miles by the afternoon away from where they were before. Another thing we have to worry about, bluefin are pigs with fins. They are very lazy. They are known to go behind draggers and tub trawlers and scallopers and every other imaginable boat. And what they do is they just sit there and they'll just eat whatever comes off the back of the boat. So when we do foraging ecology analysis, we have to be very mindful of some of the things that they may be eating and where they're coming from. So for example, your bait, we will remove that from the diet. Chum, we will remove that because it's not artificial, but it's not sort of natural. So we parse this out. So what do? I hire people who don't have good nasal capacity and can't smell anything, and they're the ones that we employ to empty these stomachs out on the table. And so we collect the stomachs, we empty all the contents out onto the table, and we start to sort them as best we can based on visual identification. And we generally start with fish, crustaceans, and cephalopods. And then from there, we try to get a little bit more specific. So we identify to the highest taxonomic level. I mentioned bluefin are warm. Just like your stomachs, The food that you just ate, not only did you chew it, but our enzymes are working at a higher rate because the temperature is higher. Bluefin stomachs are warm, so they can turn over food really quickly, and it doesn't take long for something to go from pristine to this. And when it gets to this, you have to have a way to be able to identify what it is. So stomach or foraging ecology is a little bit like detective work. We look and see if we can find anything that's obvious. If there's nothing that's obvious, we have to employ other techniques. Here are some of the other techniques that we look for. These guys, you'll find these sort of bean, you'll see these in stripers, these little bean-like structures, okay? These are actually the stomachs, or the gizzards we call them, of menhaden. And they're resistant to digestion for a very long period of time. So when we open up a bluefin and we find a whole pile of these, we can identify that that tuna had eaten menhaden. We don't know the weight, but we know how many, because we can go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, we can count them. Similarly, ow, just got the back. Similarly over here, you'll notice that there's blue bones in that fish, all kind of maybe blue, bluish green right there. That's indicative of the gar family. So that's a northern sori. So again, we can look at characteristics of the prey, even though that doesn't look like much, and we can figure out what the animals are. So it's the same thing that's in like a bruise and things like that. We can also take, if you saw those otoliths, we can also take the otoliths out of these fish here. Even though they're really digested, the otoliths are not. So you take the otoliths out, and we can create a key. And you can identify what's in the stomach by just simply taking the otoliths out of the fish or finding loose otoliths in the stomach. You can do the same thing with squid beaks. The beak of a squid is indicative to the species. So the morphology of it and all the measurements of the beak are characteristic of what the species is. And so we can do the same thing there. We do get some weird stuff. Occasionally, we get trash. So 1 gallon jug of, I don't know, oil, antifreeze or something. I got a whole coconut one time inside of one. This is without the husk. It actually had the husk on it when it swallowed it. I don't know how it was going to pass it. Sheer water. So we've found various birds. Seal pup one time was found in a stomach. We get a lot of hooks. We get a lot of hooks in the stomachs in various stages of decomposition. These are actually halibut hooks, probably from down east Maine, most likely, since that's approximately where the stomach was from. Here you can see another hook almost completely encapsulated. And we do get tagged striped bass in the stomachs from time to time. That striped bass was tagged in the Hudson River and was eaten up in Maine. Unfortunately, whoever deployed the tag, we don't know because they didn't report it. We just know who it went to. We don't know what the specifics of the fish was. But yeah, that was put out. I think that was a literal society tag. I think that's what it was. But anyway, yeah, that was on a striped bass. So what is this? What can this tell us, and why are concentrated on all this? Well, the neat part about being able to do this over longer periods of time is 2002, 2015, 2021, Atlantic herring, you can start to put together long-term patterns. And you can see that herring, I'm not going to go over all of this, we'll just focus on a couple. You can see that herring is becoming progressively less important in the diet. And other species are now becoming more important. So these are menhaden. For anybody that's from Maine or knows Maine, this is York Harbor. And for any golfers in here, depending on your swing strength, that's somewhere between a pitching wedge and a 9-iron from shore. So over the last few years, we've seen this resurgence of menhaden in the Gulf of Maine, and the tunas have followed in abundance. From the shore to Georges, we have menhaden everywhere, and this is one of the most abundant small pelagic predators that we have now. And I know it's a very important prey for striped bass too, but these are what our typical stomachs now look like, 30 to 50 menhaden in a single stomach when we get them in. And those stomachs are anywhere from 30 to 60 pounds a piece. And so again, I won't go over all of this. All I will just show you is two things. One is Atlantic herring, right here, we'll look at this one. Atlantic herring over the last 4 or 5 years is very low. It used to be approximately 60%. Now it is barely 5 or 6%. And Atlantic menhaden has taken its place. And now Atlantic menhaden has sort of usurped Atlantic herring. Makes sense, it's small, schooling, and lipid rich. So if it's there, eat it. And herring have gone down considerably in the last few years. Okay, so I got two more things to talk about and then I'll be done. We do a lot of work on stock structure. Again, in the Atlantic, we have two stocks of bluefin, one in the east, one in the west. We draw this line down the middle. The problem is, how do you tell which fish is which? How do you tell which bluefin comes from which part of the ocean? You have a school of fish, they don't all come from the same place. One neat aspect about saltwater fishes, they're always swallowing water to maintain their salt balance, and they always have to respire across their gills. And in doing so, the chemistry or the chemical signature that's in the water will cross that blood barrier either in the intestine or in the gills, and it gets deposited in those otoliths, right? And so what we can do is we can find a marker. And Dave Secor and Jay Rooker found this marker back in the mid to late 90s. And we use oxygen 18. And there's a difference in that concentration in the med. And we call it we say, you know, the Gulf here, but it's really the Gulf area. It's not just the Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of America. It's not just this area. It's actually much broader. But suffice to say, we have two areas, known spawning areas. This is a spawning area here too now, but we have two known spawning areas with different signals. And so the idea at that time was we can use the difference in those signals as a way to discriminate. How do you do that? You catch a bunch of these little ones here and here, and you catch them so small that they have not had a chance to migrate a long distance. You catch them really, really small. And what you do is you take that otolith and you mill out what we would refer to as the birth marker of the fish, that initial part of the otolith that's growing once the egg is fertilized and the fish is in its larval stage and very, very juvenile stage. And you get that chemical signature. And this is what it looks like. And you look at that and you're like, I may not be a scientist, but there doesn't look like there's a lot of separation there. And that is true. There is some noise in that signal, but by and large, the blue ellipses and the blue circles are from the east. The orange ellipse and the orange circles are from the west. And this is what we call our baseline. So once you have your baseline and you know your western signature approximately, and you know your eastern signature over here, then what you do is you put all your unknowns on top of it. Could be wreck fish, could be harpoon fish, rod and reel fish, purse seine fish, longline fish, doesn't matter. You have that unknown otolith and you lay it over the top. And then a computer basically goes and it assigns a probability to every single point, or it'll assign a probability of just being in the east or the west, and I'll show that to you right here. So this is the result of these unknowns. So in the Gulf of Maine area, including southern New England, when you run these models, approximately 60% of all the fish we catch in the West, sorry, they're from the Med. We have unassigned fish, which means there's probably some noise in that signal, probably a different spawning ground. And then here's our Western. Now, if we do away with the unassigned and we force the computer to allocate the green to either this one or this one, this is what we get. About 70% of our fish here in the West Atlantic for bluefin actually come from the Med. And around 30%, 30-ish percent come from the Western Atlantic. You can break this out even further by year. So this is 2010 to 2020. The big thing here is just look for this. These are all Eastern contributions by year. West has been going up recently, but by and large, we are heavily subsidized by the Eastern fishery, by the Eastern productivity, excuse me. And then this is just giant. So these are fish that are over in the US. Giant is considered anything over 81 inches. So again, very subsidized by the Eastern Atlantic here. And you can break it out by month and size class and things like that. So why is this important? We are the benefactors in the Western Atlantic of the productivity in the Med. And so, yes.
Did you say early on that the Med, they fish over spawning?
Sure do. They sure do. It's never going to change. Right. It's the way they've been harvesting them for 8,000 years. They will never change it.
They'd be incredibly productive if they did.
Well, the other thing is that the Med stock is 10 times more productive than the Western stock. Right. Yeah, so it's much bigger. But even still, this is why I made that point before, that it's really important to be part of the international agreements, because if we pull out of those agreements, guess what the European Union's going to do?
It's fine.
Sweet. Love it, because we're the one that'll block the vote. on their increased TAC, right? Or something like that. We might block a vote or something, or we might put up resistance or something, right? So it's really important. You can do the same thing with genetics. You do use otolith, but you can also use genetics. I take a piece of your skin, and I can tell you, right? People have done this, Ancestry.com, 23andMe, all that stuff. You figure out where you came from. You know the same thing with genetics. The cool part with this, just like the epigenetic aging, the fish does not have to die to do it. You can do it on fish that are released. So it's very cool. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. I got this one I wanted to talk about, which is what we call our close kin mark recapture project. So one of the holy grails, whether it's striped bass, marlin, bluefish, it doesn't matter. One of the holy grails about fish assessment is being able to get a reliable number, okay? And counting fish is like counting trees, except they move, they're invisible, and they eat each other, okay? So that's what you're up against. How do you get an actual number? How do you get it? Traditionally, we use mathematics and indices as a way to get that number. This is a fundamentally different way to do it. We basically are building genetic trees of the Atlantic bluefin population, and we are looking for matches between the offspring and the parents, and by getting those offspring ratios, we can get a physical number of the tuna that are in the ocean at a particular given time, plus or minus, but the plus or minus is much smaller than the plus or minus used to be, right? So it's a refinement. So how do we do it? We do a bunch of things. Collect larvae here in the Gulf. Collect the bigger fish up here. This includes the juveniles, so wreck and commercial fisheries. We mix that in with some data on where these fish are going, how long they're spending in each of the different zones of the ocean. And from that, you can get these population estimates. And we just finished the first ones. We do have matches. So every one of these larvae that's here that's tagged is a match to an adult that was captured somewhere at the end of one of these arrowheads. So we've done it. I mean, the pilot program has been successful. And the cool part about the pilot program is that the initial results suggest the biomass of bluefin from close kin is higher than the standard assessment says it is. So that's good in one way, but in another way, it's like, now what do we do? Because now we have two things that tell us different stories. How do we rectify that? Fortunately, this has all been done for southern bluefin, so we have a pathway to do it. And folks with brains that are much bigger or at least configured differently than mine that can do a lot of math are able to do it. But I just wanted to share it with you because it's a really, really powerful method that we're using. And we really need to emphasize how much we need recreational bluefin samples, fin clips. Oh, it's huge. It's massive. From a single piece of material from that fish, you can contribute to the Close Kin Project for population abundance. You can tell us what stock the fish is from. We've successfully done the sex markers. Now you can tell if it's a male or a female. I didn't do it. Chris Bridges and some other folks at CSIRO did it. So from one little tiny piece of material that's no bigger than that, we can get all of this information from that, just that little tiny piece of information. So it's pretty amazing. And this is the project that we call it Genetics for Giants and Juvies. Sorry, this is the wrong one. Genetics for Giants and Juvies, where we ask the recreational community to go out and to just take a little piece of that fin lid off. We provide the vials. We provide everything you need to do in terms of the getting the samples, you know, preserved correctly. It's all non-toxic. You don't have to worry about spilling it on your sandwich or anything like that. And everything's free of charge. We ship it to you free of charge. You ship it back to us free of charge. And we can upload it into this program. So it's a great opportunity if you want. I don't care. I've always, because a lot of people say, well, I don't fish that much. I fish maybe two times a year. I catch, you know, half a dozen fish. And I'm like, I don't care if you catch 1,000. I don't care if you catch 2. The 2 is just as valuable as the 1,000 because I said before, you never know what the 2 are going to tell you against the 1,000, right? So it, regardless of your effort or how much you put in, just do it. We do work in the offshore wind space a little bit, not to put up windmills per se, but more to be looking at how do the development or the proposed developments, how would they have an impact on HMS fisheries? So John and myself and Matt Davis at Maine DMR are working with spotter pilots and purse seiners, harpooners, rod and reelers to try to plot out where bluefin fisheries are taking place. We're also doing a lot of tagging, similar to what Greg was talking about. We've got tags on blue sharks. We have tags on poor beagles. We have tags on short fin makos. We have tags on basking sharks. And we have tags on bluefin. So we're sort of tagging a whole host of different HMS species in the Gulf of Maine in an effort to understand more about their habitat usage and their distributions and how that overlay pre, during, and post-construction may or may not have an impact on them. And we use very similar tags to what Greg was talking about, acoustic tags and pop-up satellite tags. My PhD student, Joe Delarusso, does a lot of work with post-release mortality. There are many, many more giant bluefin around now than there has been in decades. And of course, that makes them very popular. People want to catch them and people want to release them. Just like with striped bass, there are particular protocols that we think you should follow in order to ensure that the fish is going to survive. Will they all survive? Nope. And if you think that, you are not thinking correctly. Every time you grab or tug on an animal, there is a stress response. It's the same thing in Maine. We have moose that run through downtown Portland, and they tranquilize them and take them away. They don't always wake up. It's just like us, right? You know, so you sign the waiver. Yeah, sure. Put me under anesthesia. I'll wake up. That type of thing. Fortunately, we're working on the methods by which you should take care of the fish and how you should revive them. And Joe's put out 63 tags so far, and we've only had one mortality out of 63. So that's pretty good when you're considering our fish range in size from 2 to 700 pounds, and we fight them from, you know, 20 minutes to 2 hours plus. It's a very big fish, as you know. There's a lot of stress on that animal. So that's a cool project. And the last thing I'm gonna touch on, and then I'm all done, is tagging. Greg mentioned before the conventional tags by Frank Mather. That's these little streamer tags that I'm sure you're all very familiar with. This is what the conventional tagging database looks like for bluefin in the Atlantic. It's pretty extensive. One thing I would point out, which I think is the most fascinating, Frank Mather tagged a bluefin right here in the Bahamas, and then in 50 days, it was recaptured right there by a Norwegian purse seiner, right at the top. So in a little over 6,600 miles linearly in that 50-day time period, which is not true because it's, you know, fish don't swim like this. So conventional tags are cool. They do offer us some information, but really where the rubber meets the road is these pop-up satellite archival tags. I brought one. You can see if you ever catch a tuna with one, please save it. We offer a reward for these. Fairly good one. They've been used since 1997. The way that they work, you'll see that there's a tether on that tag. It's attached here to the nose cone. As Greg said, you pre-program that tag for a particular number of days that you want it to stay on the fish. Once it's ready to come off, the nose cone is bathed in seawater. There's a wire that goes through that nose cone. The battery sends a charge to that seawater. You get galvanic corrosion. The nose cone separates right here from the tag. The tag is positively buoyant. It floats to the surface, and it makes contact with an orbiting constellation of Argo satellites. That tag will start to randomly send the information in these little data packets to that Argo system, and then, as John can attest, that information will come back to us in a data portal, and then we can use that information to recreate those tracks that that Greg was talking about before. So just real quick, I'll show you kind of how the process works. We tag these fish all different ways. We tag them in the water. We've tagged them on the boat. I prefer to tag them on the boat. It just seems to be the best method for us because we're able to bring them up. We're able to get a very good measurement. We're able to get a genetic sample. We can work a little bit more efficiently. We can put the tag exactly where we want it. And as I said before, with the post-release mortality project, the fish seem to be able to handle it okay. I know Greg does most of his tagging freestyle. Can't do that with tunas. They're just way too fast. I mean, you could try to do it with a harpoon pulpit, but you don't know if you're going to hit that fish right where you want to, or if you hit him in the lateral line or here or there. So we always bring them up on the boat. And then we release them. Knock on wood, we've had really, really, really good luck letting them go and survive, and as have many other labs around the Atlantic. So take a genetic sample, electronic tag, conventional tag, measure the length, measure the girth. That gives us our weight estimate, plus or minus 50 pounds. Let the fish go out the door, and we have a swim hook that goes in the mouth. It's anchored on two points. So you hold one, it holds the barbless hook in place. You let go of that one, you pull this one, the hook just comes out, and the fish just freely swims away. That was a nice fish. That one was 950. That was a big one. And then I'll just show you some tracks real quick. We have sort of three different groups of tracks here. We have tracks that follow our normal patterns of going to the Med, which is a known spawning ground. We have tracks that follow our known pattern of going to the Gulf of Mexico, which is a known spawning ground. But recently, a lot of our tracks do this. This is a giant, tagged in the Gulf of Maine, sexually mature, should have gone to one of those spawning areas, and yet this fish spent 9 or 10 months just chilling in the Gulf of Maine and just off the shelf break. Here's another example. This one's coming out of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Same thing. These are the temperature patterns and the depth patterns. Greg's not here. I was going to say I have to one-up him. Bluefin are way better swimmers than white sharks, and they go much deeper, so they're much more exciting. We have records of fish going in excess of 6,000 feet, and in fact, the is it 1,700 meters? 1,700 meters, I think, is the crush depth of the tag, and so that tag can sense the depth, and as it approaches crush depth, it releases and comes to the surface, because otherwise the tag is no good. It gets crushed and it's no good. So we do have records of them going over 6,000 feet down. Just some more of these, what I call local fish, just sort of fish staying in the region. Especially this one is an early release, but just kind of give you an example, another early release one. Another one just zipping back and forth. We have a lot of fish that go out here into what we call the Newfoundland Basin. And for some reason, the tags pop off early. I don't know if someone's out there pulling the tags out of the fish or what. But for whatever reason, I think John can attest to this too, we have a lot of tags that come off early here. I don't know why, but this is like the Bermuda Triangle of tuna tags. Here's another really cool one. This was tagged right here. Went out, did this whole iteration, and then the tag came off right there, just east of Cape Cod, swimming with Greg's white sharks. Another one. The Slope Sea. So there's an area extending from North Carolina up beyond Georgia's Bank and out here, which in 2016 was identified as what we call the Slope Sea, presumably a third spawning ground for bluefin. And I didn't confirm it. Actually, a Narragansett NOAA employee, Dave Richardson, confirmed it by collecting larvae in these different locations. And so we know that bluefin are spawning out here too. And this tag would seem to indicate that potentially this is one of those fish. Fish was tagged here, went down to North Carolina, right in line with where that sort of Slope Sea is, and then the tag popped off right there. We have examples of these fish being tagged. They go away for a year, they come back, and the tag pops off just a little ways from where we caught it, you know, the year before. So they have some pretty amazing capabilities. Another Slope Sea spawner there. Barbara Block's lab has some Slope Sea. They have a paper out on Slope Sea spawning. They have some of these fish that sort of did the same thing. I wanted to illustrate that in this paper that they put out a couple years ago. We have fish that kind of go down here between Bermuda and Bahamas. We have some that visit the Bahamas. Some that visit the Bahamas, don't like it, go here, don't like it, go back, don't like it, go back, don't like it, go back, don't like it, go back. We have some that go off into almost no man's land. Here's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We have some recently, a few of our tags have been going off the coast of Africa, the west. So this tag popped off 20 miles west, got to get my compass bearings, west of Dakar, and floated there for a while. So we know that that fish was there with absolute certainty. We have fish that go into the Med. So here's one tagged in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and again comes into the Med. And what's nice about these is the tagging data with the genetic data with the otolith chemistry data backs up that these fish are going back and forth. And that's what you want. You want multiple methods that are telling you telling you the same thing or similar patterns. Just a few more I'll go through and then I am pretty much wrapping up. So just some more fish. Here's another one. Here's Morocco, just to kind of give you an idea of how far these fish are going. This is another one off of Portugal. Another one in the middle of nowhere, Sargasso Sea, I guess. Gulf of Mexico. So these are some of what we would expect. This one leaves the Gulf of St. Lawrence, comes down here, presumably spawns in the Gulf, comes back up, and then the tag pops off right here again. Another Gulf of Mexico spawner here as well. So we do have a fairly large electronic tagging program for bluefin. We do both acoustic tags and pop-up tags, as Greg was saying before, and it gives us some really, really important data that we can use for the assessment and management of bluefin. I'll add just a couple other papers. These are interesting, and then I'm all done. These are fish that were tagged off of Ireland, which is pretty interesting. The yellow dots are just all of the individual positions. You can see you only had one or two fish that actually crossed the line. Most of them stayed in the east. These are fish that are tagged off of the UK. Same thing, here's the management line. And you can see most of these fish stayed on the eastern Atlantic side, some of them going into the Med. And with that, I think I'm gonna wrap it up. And I usually give this talk at fishing seminars, so Canyon Runners Seminar and the Castafari Seminar and a lot of places. And being in the commercial bluefin fishery for a while, harpooning, being on a purse seiner, and doing the general category hand gear, I was well aware of all the things that you do, right? You rig your baits just specifically, and you wipe the line down, and you make sure your presentation is really good and all that. And what I always joke is, that's what you're up against, because that's the brain of a 600-pound giant. So good luck. All right, that's it. Thanks, guys. I can go back to whatever one you want.
The one that returns to that one. Yeah. So if you tag that one with a conventional tag, the trap would be pretty boring because it would only go like 2 miles. They're very valuable for a lot of reasons, but you miss the other like 7,000 pounds.
Yeah, they're very valuable tools for us.
Can you say just quickly how you geolocate this information from what you get from the tag, which is something that's
that guy can tell you?
What if I want to hear you do it?
He'll tell you. I could, but he'll do a better job.
These tags have a bunch of sensors on them. They have a light sensor, they have a depth sensor, all kinds of stuff. So these will stay on the fish. They don't do anything until they pop off the fish, and then they'll start transmitting that data to satellites. And that data gets paired with environmental data, whether it's satellite data, buoy data, whatever it is. We know from the depth data that it can't be in water that's shallower than the depth sensor says it is. With the light data, you can kind of get, based on daylight hours, you can get where it is latitudinally, and then temperature-wise, you can start to get the latitude. And so there's a whole mixture of variables that go into a model that makes these geolocation estimates.
It's like old-fashioned navigation, yep. Right? If you have your time from local noon, you know your daylight, you know your time, you know your durations of day and night. The only problem where we get a little bit, well, the tag might get a little bit like, is at the equinox. But because we have pre and post points, you can, if you had any issue, you would know that here's a point. This is the equinox, 12-12, 12 hours a day, 12 hours a night, and then another one right after where it starts to shift, albeit slightly. And so you usually can connect the dots pretty well with that.
And not to take more shots at Greg for not being here, but.
Oh, no.
Here we go.
Take them.
Very challenging thing with bluefin is that they can go down below 6,000 feet and they'll stay there. And they'll stay there for a long period of time, which there's not a lot of light data happening at 6,000 feet. So when they resurface, this is when models start to get a little bit more and more uncertain. Whereas like great whites will stay within the top 20
up top.
Meters.
They're boring.
They're really boring. They have big teeth, but they're boring.
I really do a movie about bluefin tuna eating people.
Yeah, I know. We don't quite have Greg's like Hollywood.
That
you know,
hacker got pretty close.
Yeah. So, what is the capability that these fish have to go down to 6,000? They're motivated for food.
Yeah. Presumably. So there could be a couple of things.
See, the pressure's unbelievable.
They can deal with it.
Their eyes are bigger than a coffee cup.
Yep.
So
they don't have a functional air bladder. That's the first hurdle you have to go over, right? Because if you have an air bladder and you travel that quickly, you can't off gas quick enough. But bluefin, even though you'll see a little bit of an air bladder, that the air bladder is not functional in the sense that it's not expanding and contracting to change buoyancy. They're using lift mechanisms from the type of swimming that they have. So that's the biggest hurdle right there. They are an incredibly dense animal, and they can withstand some pretty amazing pressures, and they do it really quickly. I mean, I don't know if we can actually calculate the speed, the true speed per se, but I mean, when you watch them on the sounder up where we are, I mean, they'll 200 feet in seconds. Yeah, a couple of tail flicks. They're from the top to the bottom of Platts or Jeffries or, you know, on Georges or something like that. So they're really, really fast. Their eyes, they don't have the bug out mechanism like redfish or, you know, a groundfish would have. They don't have to worry about that. They don't have any open air spaces or anything like that. So they can easily go down that far. They're a cool fish. Yeah, very cool fish. Yeah.
Two questions. So is the disparity that you see in the catch between the east and west populations due to overall population size?
You got it. It's population size. So the Eastern Atlantic is a much more, at least that's what the models say, is a much more productive stock. And because of that, they're allowed a higher allocation. Even though we know there's mixing that's involved. And believe me, they're not super jazzed that we're catching eastern fish. You know, that's been made known. So, but yeah, it's the productivity of the stock.
Okay.
Yep.
And then my second question is the model that you're using to geolocate, are you using GPT-3 or is that a different model?
We use a couple of different models. GPT-3 is the easiest one just because Wildlife Computers has it's all on their end. We have used Dr. Braun's model.
CAMS,
Cam Braun has a model that is actually a lot nicer because you can play for swim speeds. You can set a range of swim speeds. So, but the problem with it is that it's super computationally intensive. So we use it sometimes, but for general applications, we run GPT-3.
Yeah,
any ideas as to why Menhaden seem to be replacing Atlantic herring in the diet of the bluefin?
So, if you look at the fishery indicators, and your folks up the road here are the ones that do the herring assessments, but from everything that we saw, the indicators just went in the tank for herring. So their biomass just sort of fell off a cliff. I mean, there was all sorts of back and forth about gear types like midwater trawlers and what they were doing and seiners. And so that aside, the herring population has declined considerably. I don't even know how some of the boats are making it because there's just no quota to go around. And I think it was, if you want me to be completely honest, I think it was just a fortuitous set of circumstances that when herring went down, we had a gap year covered by squid for 2 years. This is up where we are. I'm not claiming to say what's happening down here, but in terms of further in the north, we had squid cover us for about a year, year and a half, and then the menhaden came in abundance. And I think they just filled a niche, and the bluefin came here, and they found them. And like I said, win, stay, lose, leave. They came, and there was a lot of them, and they just chose. Some of this probably also, there's a lot of work that looks at the sort of learned capabilities of fish to understand migration patterns and where they should go. So younger fish following older fish to some extent, there's some literature on that, even with herring. And as you saw from some of our tags, well, there's one right there. You know, obviously that fish wanted to go back to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. It didn't stop anywhere along the way per se. The model tells us that it knew where it was going and it wanted to go there. And it went back up in there, you know, in June. It didn't even stop in the Gulf of Maine. So I think to some degree, there's a lot of fish that just have sort of some kind of recognition of where they need to go, or perhaps maybe even where it's been good for them before. So I went there last year, it was good. Now I'm anthropomorphizing this a little bit, meaning I'm putting sort of a human touch on this, but I'm trying to just make the analogy that there must be something there that they recognize this is the spot, you know, this is the spot that we want to go. We were on Georges one time, and there was a fish out there, and the guy was tub trawling or something, and he had you know what a fish pick is? On a commercial drag, you know, fish, you have a fish pick to get the flatfish. He had a fish pick, and he would go on the hull, and there was a tuna. We had a big scar. I have a video of it. It has a big scar on its back, and when he dumped the guts, he would hit the fish pick, and that tuna would show up, and it followed him for like 2 weeks. He just hit that fish pick on the side and the tuna would show right up and he would feed the tuna the guts and then he would go away for the rest of the day and he'd come right back. So, yeah. Any other? Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. If spawning is occurring on slope, have larvae been found in that area?
Dave Richardson is the one who was the lead on that. His paper was in 2016. I believe they found larvae opportunistically. Don't quote me on this, but I think he found larvae opportunistically on some maybe marine mammal cruises or maybe plankton cruises. And I want to say he even did a little Indiana Jones and found some preserved samples in the Harvard archives from like the 50s or 60s. I thought that was somewhat of the backstory. So yes, the larvae have been found there, and they're at a size where they could not have been evicted from the Gulf of Mexico up. They could not have been carried up that far. And hopefully, knock on wood, hopefully, please put your hands together that the money stays. We've secured money for, I think it's a 2.5-week cruise this year, which is going to take place in the Slope Sea. And the intention is to do focused bluefin larva sampling. So that'll be huge if we can do that. And that's led by Dave Richardson at the Northeast. Well, I guess Dave's at the Narragansett Lab, but yeah. Yep. Yep. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
I don't know how to follow up our three guest speakers.